Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For the last 8 years, nearly 350 interviews, Art of the Cut has been talking with the world's best editors in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. This interview will also be available on Frame.io's YouTube channel with fantastic production values provided by the Frame.io Prod Squad. A special thanks to them. In this interview, we discuss the film Everything, Everywhere, All at Once with the film's editor, Paul Rogers. Paul has also edited the feature film The Death of Dick Long, which I saw in a packed house at Sundance a few years ago, and another called You Cannot Kill David Arquette. He's also edited the TV series Dream Corp LLC and The Eric Andrews Show.
There was a point where we were experimenting with titles, because there's a couple of moments in the film where the bits of the title come up as chapters, where we had it stretching and filling the entire frame and expanding. And it's that kind of movie where it's like, it feels overwhelming on purpose. It reaches a point where, as the viewer, it overwhelms the senses, you know, the emotions. Within a 30-second span, we're trying to make you cry and then laugh and then be scared. And so yeah, there was a lot of pieces that we were trying to set up to kind of set a foundation in the beginning. It's the kind of film where if we didn't set a solid foundation for the viewer and a root and kind of who these characters are, what kind of language the film is speaking, then an hour into the film, when things really kind of start to hit their pitch, people would just fall off the train. I remember we were doing a lot of early screenings of the film, and what we were running into a lot was each time we would tweak something, we would tweak a scene from the first 5-7 minutes, that people's reactions to the final 15 minutes were drastically different. And it really all had to do with subtle things, like a look that Joy, the daughter, would give Evelyn, her mother, leaving that out or putting that in, lingering on that, or cutting to the father. Whether people were saying, oh, I cried at the end when the father said this, or I cried at the end when the mother and daughter did that. So that was a lot of our experimentation throughout the process, was figuring out how to keep all of those in balance with each other and prevent people from going all in on one story arc and completely losing another. You know, as much as it's, sometimes we would get these incredible reactions to one thing, we wanted to make sure that everything was getting its kind of emotional due. It can really be the difference of holding on a look for a second versus cutting away right as the line is over. And there ended up being a couple of shots that we added, especially with the mother-daughter, Evelyn and Joy. So the story kind of centers around a mother-daughter relationship, Evelyn played by Michelle Yeoh and Joy played by Stephanie Hsu, who start off the film just in different places and struggling to connect. I was feeling the first couple of screenings of what I think our audience was feeling was that they felt that difficulty to connect, but they didn't feel necessarily like they cared that much. They really wanted something to hang on to that let them know that these characters' connection was important. You can narratively lay out that these two people aren't on the same page. These two people aren't emotionally connected to each other. And people will accept that. Whether or not you make them care about that is a whole different story. Just laying that out by itself doesn't make people invest in it. So towards the end of the process, they realized that they needed to just shoot one little shot of Joy driving away in tears, the daughter, like many children do with their parents when they're around them and they're getting this kind of emotional abuse, they have a hard face on. Mm-hmm. They're taking it and they're moving past it and they're trying to give it back. And it's only when you see them away, when that dynamic is split into two individuals, that you can really start to identify with that, you know?
Well, we talked about the fact that you're a father. Is that something that you felt like when you were editing, you could go, oh, I totally get this mother-daughter dynamic as a father?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this film it couldn't have been better or worse timing in terms of just like the emotional impact that it had on me. It's also just like the circumstances of the world while it was being made. So it wrapped in March of 2020. And we got maybe 2 weeks of post in before we all had to go remote, the pandemic hit. And so I had, you know, the directors are my friends. And so I had this great, you know, dream of we're going to be in the edit suite together all day, just having fun, eating lunch, cracking jokes, you know. And then all of a sudden, it was like we were all thrown into our homes, terrified. But we had this kind of salvation in this film, which is just like, it couldn't have felt more timely, the story of this film. And also just, aside from the story, just the emotions of these characters. It's about isolation, it's about struggling with identity, it's, you know, which I think we all were as a country with everything that was going on the past couple of years. So yeah, it was this really wonderful thing to have, you know, and it also was like an excuse to be together with my friends over Zoom. But I guess at the time he was 3 years old, 3 year old son. And it was interesting because I didn't have a home office. We lived in a 2-bedroom tiny house. And so I was editing, I threw an iMac with a hard drive up in the living room next to my kitchen table. My son, obviously, and my wife were at home constantly. There was no daycare. So as I'm cutting, he's running around behind me. He's watching Mr. Rogers. He's, you know, he's just like, he's a part of the environment. So I'm hearing him as I'm cutting a flashback to the baby Joy in the film. This film was made by a lot of friends. So every day I was kind of spending time with these people that I cared about. Even if I wasn't seeing them, I was looking at their work and I was proud of them and excited, and also I felt a lot of pressure because I didn't want to do wrong by them. But anyways, getting back to your question, I think that I wouldn't dare say that only someone with children could have cut this film in the way that I did or made this film, but it definitely was a little bit of a crutch I could fall back on, of just knowing that fear that you are screwing your children up, and that desire to connect deeply while also the desire to instill in them a toughness that will let them get through a pretty tough world, which I think is what the mother really thinks she's doing, is she's building armor in her daughter to survive the world that she has struggled to survive in.
Can you just talk about your connection with the actors, or your connection with a sense of truth when you're watching dailies?
Yeah, I think in a way that is the role of an editor, obviously, in a big way, is this kind of barometer of truth. Empathy was something that we discussed a lot on this film. In a way, one of the goals of the film was if people come out of this with a greater sense of empathy, that would be a huge success. I mean, I've always felt that there's a lifespan of a shot and you're in it with this person, or with the story or whatever. That's also something that I think that the directors lean on us for. They have all these other memories of the shoot and of the day, oh, loving this thing on set, but then we see it and it may not be something that we love. So they may have these little inklings that I don't know if this is actually the, and they need someone to say like, yes, this is magic. This shot is incredible, or I didn't believe this. So yeah, I mean, I like to just watch dailies like I'm just a fan of the story. I think that's the most bearable way to get through it, is to just find those moments when you're leaning in, you know, and when you don't want it to stop.
And how do you watch dailies? Do you watch individual clips? Do you string them together? What do you do?
I love a string out. Like if I'm clicking on clips in a bin, I get lost in the hierarchy and the structure. And there's just something not seductive about scene 36, take 501. I love just, it's like it's on a string out and I'm watching it as if it's a film reel. I was on that cusp in film school of, you know, they made us cut on film before we were allowed to touch a video camera. We all had our NLEs, whatever version or whatever product it was, like on our home computers, and we'd been making stuff in high school. But I love a string out. I love a string out where I can also scrub through and maybe be reminded of something. So I love a string out of a scene, but I also just love a string out of everything. And I try to rely on those because as I'm looking for something, I'll see something else that sparks something, or that's really helpful for me just as like a little memory jog or inspiration jog. Sometimes I'll get stuck on a scene, but I think you have to be able to give yourself a break and say, I'm gonna go work on the thing that I'm excited about. Maybe it's not as important to the film in general, but at this point I need to be excited again. And that can happen, you know. I'll be working on a really tough scene for a couple of days and I'll be skimming through some footage and I'll see a silly 15-second sequence that I just need to take a break and work on this and get excited about the film again. I think there's like a natural progression to a lot of projects for me where like I'm in it, I'm feeling great, I reach a point, a scene or a sequence or whatever, sometimes even just a moment. And I reach a point with it where I'm like, God, I don't, like, what am I doing? This is, everything I try is terrible. And then you need like an easy win to remind yourself, like, I know what I'm doing. I feel like editors are just, we're a little antisocial. We just don't reach out and get together and talk shop like this very often. It's such a great opportunity to just also get all the little insecurities that comes with being an editor. I feel like that sensitivity is important, and that comes along with doses of insecurity and self-doubt. And I feel like I've learned, like I have this little magic recipe for myself, a little dose of technical knowledge, a little dose of confidence in my abilities, little self-doubt, need to prove myself. Like, it's all in balance. If one of them gets out of whack, then I'm in bad shape, but like, they're all kind of valuable.
So often I think the editors that get work and the editors that people want to work with are not the greatest editors necessarily. The people are like, I got to live with this guy for a year.
Totally.
I just want a friend. Yeah. I just want somebody I can hang with.
I think, and it's the same with when editors are selecting movies to work on. I think we have to be so careful with who we decide to spend a year with. Yeah, I think that we are, in a lot of ways, therapists, you know, between the directors and the film. That there are points where you become frustrated with the film as a director, or you become scared that it's not working out how you wanted, or you just get sick of it after you've been writing it for 4 years, you shot it for a couple months, you've been in post for 6 months, like you just don't want to look at the film anymore. And I do feel like it's our job to make them love each other again and understand each other. And I sometimes find it necessary to remind ourselves that like we're making a movie and it's fun and it's silly that we're getting to do that. We're like kids who were never told to stop playing, and then we're rewarded for it and given money to do it, to do more of it. And like, that's great. And we should embrace that and not get so serious about it all the time. So sometimes I'll take a dramatic scene and I'll recut it. I'll change everything and recut it as a comedy scene or an action scene or a horror scene, just to surprise the directors and show it to them as kind of a joke, or put in a funny sound effect just for the next screening to make them laugh and realize like, oh, we can do anything. This is a playpen for us. It unlocks just like a realization like, oh, there's comedy in this scene, or like, oh, there's some drama in this silly scene that we had just been, you know, passing over, just making it this one joke thing and move on. So I think those kind of like what feel like fruitless silly exercises sometimes can be really valuable.
Something we were talking about earlier about this multiverse that's going on and how complex it was editorially to, one, have the audience, you know, realize how crazy it's going to get, and the film almost breaks, you said.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about that challenge and what happens editorially.
So the film early on, they brought me into Dan Kwan's like back office. They just went through it for 2 hours. And I remember just like having this kind of counter on my hand of every time I cried during the pitch.
Really?
Yeah, just, it was so emotional. When they pitched it to me, I was a pretty new dad. You know, like the first year or so after you have a kid, you're just kind of an emotional wreck and just so like vulnerable and open. Like there's like an Amazon commercial with a little dog in it that always like broke. I just could not make it through it after I had my kid. But it's also just an emotional story. But they pitched it to me as, we want to make a film, and then we want to break that film, and then we want to rebuild itself.
Explain that breaking the film to me.
It's hard to describe. It just reaches a point where you have to let go of trying to hold it together in, as a viewer, in your mind, and trying to make sense of everything and fit everything together. And you're going on this journey with Evelyn, the character. And this is part of her journey, is learning to let go. But we did find that like, if we did that haphazardly, or if we did it carelessly, you get frustrated and you get angry at the filmmakers. And also you just lose trust. If the film starts breaking and it just feels like a broken film, and you don't have any faith that there's a hand behind that guiding you into a place that's gonna be worthwhile. So we really had to work hard to set up, and especially in the first act, to really center people in these stories. And editorially, that meant a lot of paying attention to performances. We learned pretty early on that Michelle's superpower as an actress is her incredible ability to listen. When someone is delivering a line around her, I'm on Michelle, just listening and reacting and internalizing. You can see the words seeping into her through her face. It's incredible. The movie spans a lot of different genres and is oftentimes like switching genres within a couple seconds. And so we had to make sure that we knew the genre tropes so that we could easily access them. Dan Kwan was saying in an earlier interview that he didn't think that this movie could be made 10, 20 years ago because there's a film grammar that is recognizable to almost everyone at this point. That kind of playpen mentality, they have it when they write, they have it when they shoot. There's a lot of improvisation on set. And it's the same in the edit. Like, they love to be surprised. They give so much freedom. They love it when you say, I have a really strange idea for this scene. I'm gonna wipe the timeline clean and start over. You know, instead of like, I don't know if we have time for that. They're like, ooh, that's exciting. Don't tell me anything. I'll come back and watch it tomorrow, you know.
The big successes creatively often happen because you're given the ability to fail.
Yeah, that's interesting. You always learn something. You always learn something about the footage, or maybe you just find one new thing. You find a look. Yeah, I'm a big fan of failure on a micro level, not on a big macro level, but yeah, they definitely give you that freedom, which is really, really nice. It felt like a bunch of buddies in a dorm room, like just trying to make something that they liked, which was just a nice way to do it. There's no fences up and there's very little ego. And it's all just about whatever makes the film better. If it's in service of the film and Dan Kwan needs a week to experiment with the footage and experiment with the scene, then like I love that. And sometimes people, you know, they know what they want, but they don't know how to tell you what they want. And you're trying to figure it out and you're experimenting, but at some point it's like, if they can take the clay in their hands and build it and show you a rough version of that, then great.
I've never worked with two directors on the same project. What was that like and how did the collaboration happen between the three of you?
They've been buddies since college and they've been making little student films together and music videos and short films, and they made another feature called Swiss Army Man, which I thought was incredible. You know, they have their own relationship and I'm friends with both of them separately, and they were some of the first people I ever met when I moved to LA. So I moved to LA in 2013 and I had this rule of I'm not gonna say no to any invitation that I get, no matter how terrible it sounds, or, you know, and I went on some weird adventures because of that. But somebody invited me to Daniel Scheinert's birthday party, which was kind of a weird, like, he didn't invite me to his birthday party, but somebody invited me, and it was at a roller skating rink. And so I went and roller skated with these guys, and Daniel's from Alabama and I'm from Alabama, so we had that in common. And I didn't know that they directed films. I knew they were in film somehow. And then by the end of the night, I remember being like, these are my people. These are like, it was two or three weeks into LA, and I was like, these are the people. I had this idea coming from Alabama to LA that like, LA was not a great place. I think that Southern people have this idea of LA as this kind of like concrete jungle full of assholes. And so I've known them for a really long time and they're just wonderful people. But they've just worked together for so long that they obviously have their own shorthand. You know, I'm not tuned into every little aspect of their communication. So it was definitely a learning experience. We'd worked on a lot of smaller projects together, music videos and short films. So, you know, I knew the way that they worked together a little bit. We had a good working relationship, but this was so much bigger and so much longer and so much more complicated. And, you know, I think the first film that they made was probably like, that was where they worked out a lot of the stuff they needed to work out. It was like they had gone to therapy with Swiss Army Man, and then I was kind of benefiting from that. But they, you know, they each have their own way of doing things and they balance each other out in such a great way that it really wasn't difficult.
Tell me a little bit about your sense of, I'm an editor and so much of it is not in the timeline.
I feel like it's a good lesson to learn that if, in order to make a scene work, you feel the need to tell someone, let me tell you what went into it and how bad the performances were or whatever, or like, let me tell you why I like this look from somebody, then you're in trouble. That stuff should all be there. I also think that their work is exploring these really deep, valuable parts of our and vulnerable parts of our psyche through these kind of sometimes silly, it's like a Trojan horse, you know? You're like, this is a fun, silly movie. And then by the end of it, you're like questioning your ideas of masculinity and parenthood and empathy. And I would think that's why we work well together, is because these are things that we think about a lot as people, us three. It's hard for me to answer that question because it's not in the timeline, but it's also not something that I verbalize or talk about.
I want to dive into a little bit more about that idea of the multiverse. How do you set up the fact that this woman is who she is?
Early on, we really experimented with how do we kind of hold viewers' hands as we start making these transitions from universe to universe, so they're not just confused, like, why is she in a new place? I always thought of like the first and last time I watched The Matrix with my grandma, and she was just like angry. We had to turn it off. I love The Matrix, not to say that they did anything wrong, but like I wanted to be able to like, we're asking a lot. So let's help people. Let's help them, let's guide them, you know. Early on, it was trying to figure out what is the sound of the actual transition. We ended up using like a little kind of bell ring in reverse that would kind of like lead you and then snap you into a new universe. We experimented with a lot of stuff. I threw everything at it, like the flapping wings of a bird or, you know, just anything that I thought could be interesting. And a lot of the times throughout the film, the universes start leaking into each other as Evelyn stops being able to hold these universes all in her brain. So what does that sound like? Is it a low pass of a voice coming in? Is it a high pass? Does it sound like it's radio? Is it static? We ended up settling on this kind of staticky, almost metallic sound of voices coming through.
And did you design that stuff originally before the sound team got to it?
Yeah.
Did you do that all in Premiere?
We had to. I mean, we had to know if the film was going to work. I mean, in general, I feel like there's so many scenes where if I don't sound design it almost finished, I don't know if it's going to work. If we don't nail that, then we're just kind of kicking that down the road for someone else to figure out. And at that point, the edit's locked. There's nothing we can do about it if it doesn't work. So we spent a lot of time figuring that stuff out, yeah.
Tell me about some of the hints that you were explaining that you dropped early on that kind of lead you to go, oh, she's always been the person she is.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like, there's things early on, like in the laundromat, in the first 5 minutes, there's these little clues that things aren't gonna be the way that you think they are, that there's something else coming. And they were, you know, obviously shot and scripted that way, but it was our job to make sure that those really landed. So there's a shot where she's kind of making her way through the laundromat, talking to her husband and daughter, all these conversations happening at the same time. She's kind of kicking this stool along with her and getting up and getting laundry down. And she kicks the stool, a foot comes in, foreground, boom, stops the stool. All of a sudden you feel like you're in a kung fu movie and then you're out of it. It was a lot of that was sound design, but also editing, just holding on that. And the sound design of like, why are they emphasizing this so much? That kind of stuff was really important as dropping these clues. So that when once that stuff starts happening, it doesn't feel like it's coming out of nowhere. It doesn't feel like this movie just dropped this on me. I'm not ready for it and I don't want it. You know, one of the things we struggled with was what does it sound like? These characters are getting taken over, especially Wayman, get taken over by their alternate versions of themselves. What does that sound like? So making sure that we had a cue that was different enough from everything we had heard and recognizable enough to where whenever we heard that, even if it was off camera, we would know, oh, Wayman's getting taken over. We had to figure that out in the, you know, early, before we even finished our first cut, to know if stay on that shot of him or if that was, we were gonna have to go to VFX and do some type of weird thing. And at one point that was part of the conversation when we couldn't quite nail that sound effect. Maybe we just make it a VFX thing. But that was one of those problems that we were able to solve just in post and save money down the road and a headache and time.
Let's talk a little bit about the NLE. What was the decision? Why did you choose Premiere, or why have you always edited in Premiere?
I learned Avid in school. I learned on a Steenbeck, and then we moved to Avid. It was funny, like, you'd have Avid in the classroom, and then everybody had their cracked version of Final Cut at home. And then I moved on to Premiere once I started editing professionally. Premiere has always, like, just to me, been wonderful because it disappears when I'm using it. I love to split the screen and combine performances, or just even change the timings between actors, so make someone react or speak over a line versus waiting their turn. And I love to be able to do that in a two-shot or a wide shot. That's just not how the scene plays out. So I use Premiere all over this film to do that, to the point where I just didn't tell them. When they got into finishing, the VFX supervisor, Zach Stoltz, was like, there's like 30 VFX shots that I wasn't aware of. There are all these little split screen things, or changing an extra out in the background, or, you know, even a prop. Like sometimes I would just like the way a prop was placed better in another shot, so I would throw that in. I can temp together VFX in Premiere in a heartbeat. A lot of this movie relied on us being able to show what the heck was gonna be there eventually. And so we would mock together so much in Premiere without having to go to After Effects. It's really powerful in that way. And not having to like get a bunch of temp VFX and get a temp mix or some temp sound design from anyone else except for ourselves, you know, we'd be working up till the hour before the screening, and that was really valuable. And I think that a premiere, that's the only way that I imagine that could have happened.
Were you listening? Were you monitoring in 5.1 or just stereo or LCR?
Just stereo, yeah. I just trust Brent Kaiser, who did the sound at Unbridled. And that's kind of part of the fun, is once I go on the stage and hear it, it blows me away.
You mentioned productions. Some people would know what productions is, but it's actually new enough that maybe people don't. Could you explain what productions means?
Yeah, the way that we work and the way that our company, Parallax, the way we've always worked and the way that I've always worked with the Daniels is incredibly collaborative, passing sequences back and forth. Whatever it takes to make the film better, whoever wants to take a crack, go for it. Productions is the first time that we've been able to do that without having to, you know, email a project file or make a whole new project for somebody. So basically it just allowed Daniel to jump into my sequence and see basically live what I was doing. I could just hit save, he could jump in and he could see exactly what I'd just done 10 seconds before. So it's just it's a way of sharing bins and projects and a way of allowing a team of people. We've had 12 editors working on a project. We're all sharing sound effects, we're all sharing music, footage, in a really, really fast, kind of seamless way. You'd have a project with little folders in there. Now, each folder is its own project, but that project is shared and can be opened by anybody at any time, anywhere, as long as they're keyed into that production. So you don't store your media in your main project, which means your project is really not bloated. It's quick to save, it's quick to open.
That's a big one. I've been on Premiere for a long time, and that was one of the early knocks was project files would get too bloated, and productions really is the solution.
But I think that was a result of the fact that Premiere could do so much that people were just going nuts in their timelines and just temp VFX, and they were sound designing the crap out of it, and you could build these 60 track monstrosities of a timeline, layering stuff and doing this insane color work, that of course our projects got bloated. Like, we had no limit. What they finally figured out is how to let us do all that stuff and on the back end just kind of take care of it so that we're not working in these monstrosities of a project.
Outside of the editing timeline itself, what are some other tools inside of Premiere that you found that you used on this project?
There's a lot of untapped stuff in Premiere that I really need to get more into. What I did use a lot of in this project was Frame.io has a plugin. So we use Frame.io to post our cuts. We use it to do our screening. So we would all get on Zoom, I'd send out a frame link, and then we would 3, 2, 1, everybody hits play, and I could watch everybody's face. You know, it's such an important part of it, which is nice actually about the Zoom screenings, because when you're in a room for a screening, it's awkward if you're sitting directly in front of someone staring at them.
Looking at them.
But that's what you get to do on a Zoom screening, is just, and you can make someone, if you really like someone's reactions, you make them fill the screen and you just watch them, you know. So we would use Frame for that. And, you know, we would do these kind of remote sessions where they would give me verbal notes. But what Frame allowed us to do was it allowed them to sit, watch a scene over and over and over and over again, frame by frame, draw an idea, draw a thought, and then leave me kind of like a well thought out note or idea, versus the pressure that's in the room sometimes with a director and editor where they're like, I need to tell this guy what I want, but I don't quite know what I want. And so Frame allowed them to take their time, and was nice for me because I would get these well-formed ideas, and they would also be in the comments on Frame. So that was useful for me to see the way that they would go through that. But I also had the Frame plugin in Premiere so that I could post that, they could give 70 notes or ideas, and then I could import them directly into my timeline. I think our first cut was 2 hours and 50 minutes. I think we got it down to 2:10-ish, which was a lot. We lost a lot of fun stuff.
What were some of the reasons why scenes, because everybody always says this, it was a great scene and it had to get dropped. You're like, how can it be a great scene and it had to be dropped?
Yeah, in general, I think that there's a lot of moments sometimes where you're thinking like, God, this moment is so good, but it doesn't service the film. Maybe it slows it down, maybe it hints at another narrative between two characters that you just don't deliver on later. You can't, because you don't have the footage, or that just complicates the film in an unnecessary way. We had this one scene with Jamie Lee Curtis, and she, in this scene, was incredible. She was so compelling and mesmerizing to watch. But I kept struggling with this scene, and it took us like 5-6 months to eventually, you know, we were watching it, and we were like, gosh, you know, what if Jamie Lee wasn't in this scene? Can we just try it? It's this really intense scene And then all of a sudden it becomes this weird existential crisis slash comedy tragedy scene with her character. And you're ping-ponging back and forth between these two places. So we just took it into After Effects and did a rough job just cutting her out because she's in all the shots. And we realized it's feasible. So let's give it a shot. And then all of a sudden, it just unlocked the scene.
Are there any features and capabilities inside Premiere you especially love, or like other than just that it disappears?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the big thing, right?
That
for
is
any
the big
NLE
thing.
Is just, it's my brain and the material.
Yeah, there's very rare circumstances where I will have to think about how to do something. It just, by this point with Premiere, it's second nature. I got really hooked on time remapping keyframes as opposed to kind of a universal change a clip to a certain speed, because we were doing so many fight scenes and a lot of crazy multiverse transitions. So having something go from 100% speed to 136, back down to 115 for a split second, up to 200, back down without it feeling jumpy, with a push in and, you know, the aspect ratio changing, like we were doing that all in the timeline. So that was pretty incredible, I think. And I think Premiere was a game. Luckily, I can't imagine like having to the workflow of having to do that in any other NLE.
Did you ever feel like to be able to match something you needed to jump into the color capabilities of Premiere?
I did. Yeah, we did it occasionally, especially as we were kind of doing our genre stuff. Sometimes it was like a little color shift, make something a little more moody. We played around with everything. That was the thing, is like they're just open to any way you can get your point across, whether it's sound or color. Like we would throw it all at the film. In a lot of ways, it's just our abilities as editors that's most valuable is just our taste. Like, do we have good taste? Do we know when something's working and when it's not working? Like, that's really a lot of what we're doing.
Did you use Frame.io for the entire workflow, even back into the dailies?
If we had been on this remote workflow, we probably would have. Early on in the edit, I was exporting scenes for them to watch. My work hours were so strange because I was also daycare. I was daycare for the first half of the day while my wife worked. She'd take over and I would work through the nights. So I would send them a scene at 1 a.m. and they'd review it while I was at the park, you know, playing with my my boy, and then I'd get their notes and we'd talk when I came back. And that was really when Frame started just becoming the thing that we were using every day.
Had you used it before on any projects?
Yeah, we use it at Parallax. We use it at my work a lot. That's how we do all of our client reviews. We post dailies in there. We get transcodes from set there. We've been using it for years.
Is there any way to quantify what that's worth? Like for me, one of the things that I thought was the most valuable that you mentioned was when you're doing a real review, which you kind of want to do, right? I would rather have the director there with me than review through some remote thing. But having that remote thing allows them to be more critical or more intentional about their notes.
It's true. I mean, we were talking about empathy earlier, and I don't think you can also discount the fact that when you show something that you've done, people want to be complimentary. It's just human nature. Even if they are not consciously doing that, they might be pulling their punches a little bit. And occasionally, it was nice to let them go away, watch something on Frame, and come back and be like, you know what? That moment doesn't work. We thought it worked in the room, but we were caught up in the moment. We were propelled by that scene before us. We were feeling good. If you look at that moment on its own, I've replayed it 50 times in Frame. We got to keep working on it. That's really valuable because, you know, we're all human beings. And sometimes it's late at night or early in the morning, you haven't slept, and, you know, you need time to just sit with something.
I know that the audience is going to be disappointed, but I think you and I should go get a drink and keep this discussion going. But
definitely.
Seriously, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah,
it was
thank
super
you.
Interesting to talk about this film.
I love
really
this film.
Excited.
I'm excited that you're the first person I've gotten to really talk about it with, so this is great. Thank you so much for having me.
Huge privilege to talk to you about it.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. This interview will also be available on Frame.io's YouTube channel with clips and fantastic production values provided by Frame.io's Prod Squad. A special thanks to them. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to my guest, Paul Rogers. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hullfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews of the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And keep an eye on Frame.io's YouTube channel for upcoming video episodes of the Art of the Cut podcast. I'm Steve Hullfish. Thanks for listening.